My name's Kirk, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm not nervous at all. It's no, really, you can probably hear my heart in the back of the room. But this is a great thing, and thank God it's finally here. You know, Franco called me like 3 weeks ago to tell me I was going to be the 10-minute speaker. And you can do a lot of thinking in 3 weeks. This morning I got, I'm a paramedic fireman here in town, and I was laying in bed, and it was about 6:30 this morning, and Franco was on my mind, and what I was going to say here today was on my mind, and we got an ambulance call, and my stomach was in knots, and just all the stuff was going through my head about what I was going to say today and stuff, and we got a call down here to the Ryzen, and it came in as a 50-year-old male who was having chest pain. And we arrived in the back in the annex building, and we made it up to the room 3, whatever it was, and we walked around the corner, and it was Milt, and my jaw just dropped, and we got a chance to work him up, and he's doing fine and stuff, but it was just like, it just seemed like such a God shock to me. Here I was in knots, and I just didn't, you know, worrying about what was going to happen here today and stuff, and you know, just being an alcoholic, having that alcoholic thinking, and there it was, the Milt with 42 plus years of sobriety, and you know, it was just, it's just a real neat thing. And I met his wife, and Mick were out there, and we got a chance to take him down to the hospital, and after we did that, I kind of wanted to talk to him, you know, I kind of wanted his insight on what to say today. And the nurses wouldn't leave him alone. And so I got a chance to go out and talk to Mick and Florine, and I told him that I was a member of TLAC. And I got to talk to him for a minute out there, and we just conversed for a minute, but we had to get back in service and back to the station. And when I went back to the station, I got all my stuff, and I drove back down to the hospital, and I talked to Milt. And I went and got a chance to be alone with him, and he just told me, he says, just be yourself. He says, that's why you're up here, just to be yourself. And we get a chance in Alcoholics Anonymous to finally come back and be ourselves here. You know, I don't know what the hell I was before, and I hope I never see it again, but I get a chance to come back and just be myself. And he wanted me to tell everybody here that he's doing all right. And he wanted me to relay that message to you guys. And it was a special moment. And he fell back asleep, and I walk out kind of teary-eyed and stuff, and I went home, and I went and talked to my sponsor and stuff. But, you know, you just get a chance in here to change everything. It's just such a life-changing event, and you take it for granted sometimes. I know I do. And, you know, and they talk about live one day at a time, one day at a time. You hear that over and over and over, but it really is. You know, and the good thing about this whole thing for me is, you know, I had 3 weeks to reflect on what a great program this is. You know, the wonderful things that have happened in my life. My wife's here today. She's never seen me speak before. She's never been to a meeting. And this year I'll be coming up on 5 years, and hopefully I can get her in for that meeting. And we've been married 10 years as last week, and that stuff wasn't going to happen 8 years ago. Just a miracle. It's just a miracle being up here. You know, I'm still a little nervous, but you know what? I just feel so relieved right now. And I feel so grateful for what this program has given to me. You know, the other day, last Thursday, they had a meeting at TLAC, a 9 o'clock meeting. It was packed, and Milt was there, and Mick, and I think Dal shared, and my stomach was just in knots. I was seeing all these people come in, and they were just so happy to be back at TLAC and to see it. And we forget that, you know, this isn't, you know, this is a convention, but this is like a family reunion. You know, it's unbelievable. These people come back from far, far away, and they remember where their roots are and how they're doing. And later that day, and I walked out after that meeting, and I was like, I was just a wreck. And young Mike came up to me, and he goes, hey, you want to go play golf? And I was like, I just wanted to kiss him, you know? So we went out and played golf that day, and I got a chance to get out of me. And Kenny played with us, and these guys need a lot of help with their golf. And I got a chance to get out of me, and that's how this program works for me. I get a chance to get out of me, because sometimes this thing up here is very sincere and very heartfelt, but sometimes it's broken. And I get a chance one day at a time to do what I have to do. You know, back in my drinking days, I had a friend that told me when I drank, I turned into King Kong, Fred Astaire, and Diamond Jim Brady, all wrapped in one. And in 1992, when I came into this program, King Kong, Fred Astaire, and Diamond Jim Brady was long gone. You know, he was long gone. My drinking really started taking a curve in the 90s. Don't know what happened. The road kind of went like this, and I took one of them, and I don't know which one it was, but it was the wrong one. And it really wasn't. You know, I'm from a family of alcoholics, from grandparents to mother to three older brothers to cousins, and, you know, it's in my family. But I knew that I'd taken that wrong trail at that time, and I just couldn't figure out what to do. You know, I have family members in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I could not figure out what to do about this disease. That's how baffling it was to me. And I got a chance to, you know, later that year, I came back from a big bender in January, and I went on the wagon, as we all know, for about 90 days or 80 days or something like that, all by myself. I knew I had a problem, and I knew I had to do something about it. And I remember coming home in April, and it was starting to turn springtime, and everybody was playing golf and starting to get back into that summer mode as they do up here after a long winter. And I remember seeing beer in the refrigerator, and I remember picking up a beer and going, well, now I get to find out if I'm really an alcoholic or not. And within 2 to 3 months, I was just a mess once again. It had just killed me. And I had to put my poor wife through all this stuff too, and her kids. You know, I have 4 stepkids through this, and the guilt that I felt. You know, when you ride an ambulance for a living, and you're going in your life, and you're being paid to take care of people, and you're not even taking care of yourself, there is a tremendous amount of guilt, and I hated no one more than I hated myself. And in July, my stepdaughter was to move in our house, and I knew that I had to curb my drinking. And it just got worse. It just got worse. And on July to the 24th, I believe the day was, I remember I was sitting in my bedroom, and the curtains were drawn, and it was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and the lights were out, and the door was shut, and I was sitting on my bed drinking a beer. And my wife and I weren't really talking at that time. And my brother popped his head through the door. And my brother was in the program, and we talked, and I drank, and he talked, and I drank, and he talked. And my wife and I, we kept switching rooms. She didn't want to be in the same room with me, and I didn't want to be in the same room with her. And about 8 o'clock that night, my brother called Alcoholics Anonymous, and he said, would you be willing to go to a meeting? And I said, yes. And that was, I think, my first surrender. And later that next day, we went to the 2 o'clock meeting at Tulac, and I thought I was going to know everybody. I drank in bars all over town. I thought I was going to know everybody in the room. And I walked in the room, and there was like 30 people in there, and I didn't know a soul. And I was like, oh, my God. And we sat down, and a few minutes later, Stretch walked in. And I finally, somebody I knew walked in. And I remember they went around the room, and they started talking, and Stretch talked. And my brother leaned over to me and said, that is what the program is all about. And, of course, I didn't know. Yeah, higher power, whatever, all this other, everything just choo, 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 choo. I remember I was just getting up, and I was so dehydrated. And that was the start of it all for me. That the seed had kind of been planted, and I remember coming to a meeting a few days later, and I saw Big Dan, and he told me that your drinking will never be the same. And boy, was he right. But I came in and I just started working on the outside of Kirk. I didn't work on the inside. I tell people that, you know, when I first came in, I wasn't all an alcoholic. I was just part of an alcoholic. And when you're only part of an alcoholic, you don't have to do those steps and stuff. You don't need a sponsor. But really what it was fear. Fear that I was going to fail. That's the honest truth. I didn't think that I could stay there. But I managed to stick it out for 15 months. And boy, did my life get better. Just not drinking made my life so much better. I was able to, I lost like 20, 25 pounds. My wife and I, by the help of Stretch and his wife, bought a new house within 9 months. I mean, things were just happening, and you're so overwhelmed. I mean, just the good things. And, you know, I still saw those steps, and I still saw all that stuff and that sponsor stuff. And I still, you know, well, I don't really need this. My, you know, those people need it. My stuff is going real good right now. And we went on a vacation in 15 months later, and it was to Jamaica. And there was an all-inclusive resort. And when I got off that plane, I knew I was going to be drinking. This warm feeling came over my body, and I had no tools. I had absolutely no tools. I had nobody to call. I had nobody, you know, I was doing it all on my own. And I drank that week. And, you know, when you're married and you haven't been drinking for 15 months and your wife's real proud and you start drinking again, shit changes. She was not real enlightened with my drinking at that time, and she wasn't real shy about letting me know that. And but we did. We ended up having a real good time. We were with my brother and sister-in-law from Michigan, and we had a good time. And we came back, and I stopped drinking, I think, a couple days before I came back. And when I came back into the meeting with my tail between my legs, stretch was Sharon. You know, what a God shock again. And I had to come clean. But once again, I wasn't ready, you know. I heard Marshall Wallace say a couple years ago, when you have ears to hear, you will hear. When you have eyes to see, you will see. And once again, I was going to do it my way. And as it went on, I couldn't stay clean and sober again. I went back out drinking about 7 months later. And I tried to get back in and get what I had, what I thought I had, and it wasn't working. I was a mess. I worked the 28-day program, and then I went to 21 days, and then I went to the 10-day, and the 8-day, and the 6-day, and you know, and then I just started drinking, and after about 9 months of pure hell, I just said, I got to get away from here. I felt too guilty. I felt so guilty because in my heart, I knew what was right and what was wrong, and boy, that just it just tore me up. And so for the next 9 months, I run amok. I try to control my drinking, come June of that next year, it was 1996, and this was my first fall festival, but that year I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had that hole in the soul. And the day before I came back in, or 2 days before that, I remember like getting up, and I was going to go play golf with my brother-in-law, and I was in a blackout, and I had done something that night, and my wife was just screaming at me, and she told me, if you're going to be drinking today, don't come home. And I think That was the part that hurt me the most. And I knew that I couldn't quit drinking on my own. And I was driving to Reno, and on my drive to Reno, I was so upset, and I knew that I was going to be drinking. And I didn't know. I was just real confused, but I had to stop over and buy two beers. After my wife, the person I'd loved and married, got through screaming at me, and within a half hour, I had two tall beers, and I was drinking them down to make that pain go away one more time. Making it trying to go away, and I ended up going out with my brother-in-law, and I didn't go home that night. I stayed at his brother's house on the couch, and when I woke up, I just knew it didn't work anymore, and I was so sick and tired of being sick and tired, and I went home, and thank God my stepkids were at the house, because I knew my wife wouldn't be on screaming at me and stuff, and I remember sitting on the couch for a day or two, and then I finally creeped back into the meetings. And I was so afraid to go back to the meetings, because everybody was going to make fun of me, and everybody was going to look at me, and he's a failure, And the weirdest thing happened. They said, "Welcome back." The hands went out. The hugs came in. And I remember Marty running over to me, and he says, "Why don't you try not getting well so quick this time?" And for some reason, my hearing was different. My vision was different. And things just started to work. And that first month was awesome. It was awesome. I mean, when you go in and you know it's clicking, it's just something is different. What is different? I don't know. I'm not going to ask any questions. And I got a chance to share a little bit, and I got to work with Taxi Bill a little bit. And that was a little different. But, you know, I love Taxi Bill to death. Yeah, he told me some great things in that first month. You know, he said things like, you know, if you're having trouble getting 30 days, the county jail has a real good program. He also said... one night when I got close to 30 days in there, I was walking around, and I was talking, and I was upset about something, and it was really bothering me, and I just didn't know about the program and stuff. And he said, "Hey, look, man, this is an all or none program. If you're not willing to do it all, you need to go finish your drinking." And that stopped me in my tracks. That absolutely stopped me in my tracks. And at that time, I knew that I was going to step study meetings and stuff, and I never did the steps, and I just knew that I had to dive into this program. I had to dig my own hole in this program and get involved in this. And I shared it 29 days. You know, next day I had 30 days, and I shared it. And Mike F. came over to me, and he said, "I heard going back out in your share," and I was pissed. How dare he say that to me? And you know what? That's just what I needed. I needed somebody to come over and not give me a little pat on the butt, but give me a kick in the ass. And I was so mad at him, I was going to show him that I was not going to drink. And I did not. And as the time went on through this program, you know, I got a new sponsor. I started working with Ed. And I don't know where Ed is out here, but thank God, you know, thank God I met this gentleman. And we have absolutely nothing in common except to be sober. He's just a guy. He spoke, and he spoke from the heart, you know. And through my marriage, he talked about his grandkids, and he talked about not being able to see his kids growing up, and he had grandkids now, and how different that was for him. And I never had children, and I got a chance to. I had step grandchildren because I married into this family, and it was the greatest gift that I'd ever been given. This small child just loving me, you know. And you forget about those little things in life. I've always trying to fix everything on the outside. I'm going to buy a new car. I need a big screen TV. I need to do this. I need to do that. You know, and that's not how it works here. It's an inside job. It needs to come from the inside out. And I finally started to realize that. But that goes away sometimes too. Don't get me wrong here. But, you know, I got Ed and we got the chance to start working on those steps. And he had me write my first step. He says, I want you to write about this guy you know named Kirk. And, step out of yourself and write about this gentleman you know named Kirk. Well, not gentleman, this guy you know named Kirk. And I started writing, and I started crying, and I started writing, and I started crying, and whew, the truth finally came out. And we did that first step, and what he was really having me do is he was having me do a fourth step, or at least part of my fourth step. And we got to go through those steps together. And when we did that, we got to my fourth step, and I was telling him the stuff that I was going to the grave with. And after we got through, he said, that stuff happened to me too. And it took all the power out of it. And what a ride it's been. He says, you are on a journey from your head to the heart. And this, along this journey, you know, you're just going to run into strange things. You know, every day isn't Christmas. Every day is not Christmas. And, you know, that first year when you get in here and everything's just going just right and stuff, you know, you're not ready for battle for that second, third, and fourth year. And I've learned those things now. You know, I would say to Ed, you know, well, how am I going to get through this stuff? Or how are you going to get through the stuff that you're going through? And he would just tell me, you just put one foot in front of the other, and it'll be okay. It's that simple. It's really that simple. And, you know, I just wanted to say one last thing here. I could go on, you know. You can't not think about this stuff for 3 weeks and only talk for 10 minutes. But I know we got other speakers that need to get up here, but... you know, this is just an absolute fabulous program. It's changed my whole life. You know, and my wife will tell you in a minute, I'm no prince. You know, and I know that today. King Kong, Fred Astaire, and Diamond Jim Brady are long gone. Long gone. But, you know, I get a chance every day to wake up. And my wife tells me she loves me every day. And that is a true gift of this program. Thank you.
Thanks, Kurt. And it gives me great pleasure to introduce Claire from Los Angeles.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Claire, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be sober and a proud member, of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to thank Ty and the committee for the honor and the privilege to be asked to come and share my experience, strength, and hope with you, which is always a privilege to share any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. What a beautiful morning, and I'm sure a prayer for, is it Ty? Is it Ty?
Milt.
A prayer for Milt in our hearts this morning, and I'm sure our prayers will get him through. I'd like to welcome the newcomers this morning to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, those of you who are attending the conference for the first time. And one of the favorite readings in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the basic text of our program, in the back of the book, it's called A Spiritual Experience. And at the end of that reading, it says, contempt, pride, and investigation will leave a man in everlasting ignorance. So I hope you'll just keep coming back with an open mind. You know, I stand here and thank you so much for your hospitality this weekend. I have spoken in the area before a number of years ago, and it's such beautiful country. I just love looking out at that beautiful sunrise this morning and looking at your smiling faces. And it always makes me feel the same feeling, as if I'm standing in the sunlight of the Spirit. And I'm just so grateful to be here. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a full-blown winette. And in the big book in chapter 3, more about alcoholism, it explains the insane things we sometimes continue to do to keep from doing step 1, 2, and 3. And in that list of insanities, one of them says we switch to natural wines. Well, man, I had switched to Ripple. And that is not one of your natural wines. As a matter of fact, I don't even think a single grape was ever near that stuff. I don't know. They probably just put it in a bottle and shook it up. Probably put a little Kool-Aid in it to give me a choice of colors. That was a white Ripple or a grape Ripple. So I had my first drink when I was an honor student at the Boston Museum School of Fine Arts in Boston. And I was born and raised in Atlanta, Georgia. We tell our story in a general way, what it used to be like, what happened, what it's like now. And there I was, you know, a naive little girl out of Georgia, had no idea about alcohol, never knew it existed on the planet Earth. Georgia was a dry state when I grew up there. And I walked into a jazz club and had a drink one night, and I didn't know that when I took that drink, the drink was going to take me and I was going to give that the power for the next 27 years of daily drinking. And that I was going to end up in South Central Los Angeles in a fetal position, dying emotionally and spiritually and physically, dying with this disease. I had lost everything by that time. We'd had an older son. My oldest son was born in Boston. The two younger ones were born in Los Angeles. The marriage was over 24 years of a very sick relationship where we both ended up absolutely doing a dance with death. And me with that wine it was still in the paper bag. And we had gone into a small business when we arrived in Los Angeles that had become successful, and I don't know how to deal with success. You know, I always was afraid of success and afraid of failure. So I lived in that dilemma. So I had to live in my own little world, and I just lost everything. I never knew I'd stand at the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous and say, "Thank you, God, that you took away from me everything I wanted in order to give me what I needed." Came that time in my life when I needed to stop drinking. I needed to find a God of my understanding. And I simply need to stop dying. Standing outside that house, watching the marshal put the lock on the door, and that older son was 12 years older than the two younger children that were born in L.A., and my family, who loved me so much. I'm the youngest of seven children, and I'm the alcoholic in the family. I believe I'm the one that was born restless, irritable, and discontented. You know, right out of the chute, man, you know. I could have had a little drinky poo. Probably in the first grade, you know, just to get me to the second grade. I had problems with people, and, you know, as I grew up, I just couldn't stand people, and they were everywhere, you know. I'm standing outside that house, and my family had all moved to the West Coast from the East Coast, where they'd my parents had given us the best education. We were all everybody was doing well but me, because I was in the throes of my alcoholism. And I was trying to save things one more time, watching the marshal put the lock on the door and the bank take my equipment. I was in property management and maintenance business. And I remember going over to Cedar Sinai Hospital, and to my oldest sister, who was a nurse there. And I looked at her with that look. We always look. I always had those alcoholic prayers, and you know, always looking for somebody else to fix me. So I went over there and I looked at that sister and I said, you know, can't you just, you know, save the house one? And she looked at me. She said, not this time. It seems to me the loving God that I've come to believe in was working in their lives at that time because they started to say, no, thank you, God. And she said, it pains us to watch you live the way you live. And it pains us even more to watch you die. We're not going to sign any more checks to get you out of trouble. And I looked at her and I turned. You know, I don't know if you've ever had that experience of people who love you so much, looking at you, and I could see her pain. And I had no idea I was an alcoholic. I just knew maybe I drank a little too much, but it was always everybody else and life itself. And I just turned and walked away, and I'm standing in front of that house. That oldest son is 18 years old now, and I had never been there for him. I pushed him off on the grandparents to raise him, and it was easier for me to sit on bar stools because I was a bar drinker and a nightclub drinker and hanging in those places all the time, and I was too busy to be a part of his life when he was growing up. There's a paragraph in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous that says, selfishness and self-centeredness, we think, is the root of our troubles. And it goes on in that paragraph to say we're driven people. And we're driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity. And I could have added to my list of all those fears, you know, that I didn't even know what the fears were about most of the time. I was always in a state of fear. And we stood outside that house, an 18-year-old young man, who looked at me and said, I'm not going to the ghetto with you. I don't even know who you are. And he said, you have never been there for us. And I stood there and I looked at him and my heart was so sad. And, you know, all I could say to him was, but you don't understand. You know, if I knew better, I'd do better. I'm doing the best I can. But my arrogance said, screw you too. And I turned and walked away because by this time, I'm crying silent tears about those broken dreams and those unresolved relationships, you know, that I could never find a solution to. And I picked up that bag and I took those two kids and I ended up in the ghetto, South Central Los Angeles, continuing the dance. Moved into a little house that had, I drew the drapes, and I'm sure I was doomed to die of this disease. By now, my attire is a terry cloth robe, you know, sitting in an overstuffed chair, and I used to wear this bright red wig. It had bangs. I come from the jazz world, Boston, New York, Harlem, and L.A. And I'd been out in that jazz world. A lot of you are too young to remember, but it was at a time when it was wonderful to drink if you're going to start to drink. And I became quite friendly with the likes of the late great legend Billie Holiday, Louis Armstrong, you know, Dinah Washington, all of the greats of the time. Bill Wilson, who's the co-founder of our program, and I believe this program was divinely inspired. And he, too, was a jazz lover, and he loved those clubs in New York City, and I just loved hanging in them, you know, all the time. And I'd sit in that chair and come out of the blackout. I'm a real alcoholic, the kind that's described in the Big Book. And around 10, 11 o'clock, I'd come out of a blackout, and, you know, looking good out there in the street, you know, almost killed me. Trying to take care of the outside, because living in the fast lane and, you know, I'd had an affair with the head of the mafia in Boston, and you know, I'm riding around in limousines, and now I'm sitting in this overstuffed chair with this red wig on. And when I come out of the blackout, you know, and I look in the mirror, and the wig would be on sideways. But I knew what I had to do. I could feel my heart pounding like a drum. And sometimes my heart would beat so rapidly it would seem to me it was going to explode just from the pain. And I knew what I had to do is get up out of that chair and get over to the nearest sleazy bar down on Western somewhere. And, you know, there's a little paragraph in the Big Book and a vision for you that said, some of us. Some of us sought at places, looking for understanding, companionship, and approval. You know, loneliness is part of this disease. And that husband had long been gone, and I'm dying, as I said, inside, and I don't know what else to do with my life. So I just need to get over on that bar stool and find some kind of companionship just to talk. You know, I don't know about you, but, you know, I'd sit on that end stool and look in that mirror behind the bartender and probably feeling like that song about Eleanor Rigby, wondering where all those other lonely people were coming from. And I don't know about you ladies, but I met a lot of out-of-work airline pilots, you know. One told me he was on vacation. I don't know how you go to the ghetto of South Central Los Angeles for vacation. Once in a while, I'd meet a neurosurgeon. But the one I really shall never forget is the one that was sitting. I was sitting there one night, and we all those geniuses looking in the mirror, solving the problems of the world. And he turned to me, was sitting on my left, and he was very attractive, kind of the Denzel Washington type. And he smiled, and he introduced himself. He said, I'm a retired lieutenant colonel in the United States Air Force. I was really impressed, because he was about 24 years old. And he was very nervous. We were both sipping our 59-cent wine. He's looking up and down the bar. And I got a little nervous. I thought he was going to tell me a military secret or something. And he said, actually, baby, he said, I'm a U-2 pilot. And I didn't know what a U-2 pilot was at the time. And he looked around a few more times, and he said, I fly secret missions. Now I know I got a nutcase on my hands, you know, and I'm looking at him sipping off my wine. He looked around a few more times, and then he whispered in my ear, and he said, last night I flew over Russia. Took a sip, and I said, I know you did, darling, because I was with you. That's the way it was. But I don't know what would happen. You know, the legal closing of bars in L.A. is 2 o'clock in the morning. It was then. I don't know about now. I don't go to bars anymore, but it was then. And I don't know what would happen, because I'd go in one of those blackouts. And I lived in this little apartment off of a side street. And I would come to again out of another blackout at that awful hour of the morning, 3 and 4 and 5 o'clock in the morning, in a fetal position in tall, wet grass, and listening to the birds that in California, they are called night birds, and they come out almost at the stroke of 12. And they come out in April to September. And they live up in the tall palm trees. And there I am in a fetal position listening to these birds walking back and forth. And it always seemed so cold. And it always seemed so dark. And it always seemed darkest right before dawn. Dogs traveled in that area in packs. All sizes of dogs. And in those days, they had metal trash cans on the sidewalk. And I'm lying in that grass and watching these dogs go by. And it would take several of the dogs to push the can into the streets. And they were all looking for food. When you live in the ghetto and in that kind of environment, it's all about survival. And I can still remember the sound of the lid. And it would roll down the streets and wobble down. It seemed as if the whole world was asleep. And I'm listening to my heart pound, and I'm saying my favorite alcoholic prayer, God, if you just get me out of this one. I'm never going to drink like that again. I'm never going to do those things I do again. And the consciousness, my consciousness would come before my my face and my the eyes of my little daughter who was 8 years old. And she'd look at me with those beautiful brown eyes and say things to me like, "Mom, you always promised me that you come in the PTA meeting, but you get drunk." Can't tell you how that pained me. She said, "But all my friends' parents come. How come you can't get to a meeting?" And I'd look at her, and I'd say, "Well, you know, Tina, next time there's a PTA meeting, just let me know, darling, and I'll be there." And by the grace of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, on April the 9th this year, I'm sober 26 years from my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I haven't been to a PTA meeting yet. So. Because what would happen is the phenomenon of a craving would start. And you see, in the minute, and when I got up off that ground, the next insane thought in my mind was I needed a drink. I'd get up off that ground, try to brush the dew off my shoulders, and straighten up the wig, look around, see who's looking. I'm going to be looking good out there drunk in the front yard. There was a lady that lived across the street. I don't think that woman ever slept. I don't know if you guys have ever had a neighbor like hers. But I did not go to the ghetto of South Central Los Angeles to become sociably accepted in the community. I was down there because I didn't have any place else to go. But I don't think this morning, I look across the street, you know, with the ego. I had such a huge ego. I look across the street always at her husband. I always thought she was looking at me. I don't know why, but I'd see her little curtains moving back and forth. Now I get my cool look standing in the yard, you know, staggering. And I give her the finger. Stumble up the steps, you know, get through that front door, lean on the door. You know, by this time I am drinking all of my meals. The grandparents had taken the 8-year-old daughter and the 12-year-old son because I was at a point where I could no longer function. So I'm leaning on the door, and I don't know what's going to come up this time. It's going to be that blood or that green vial. But I charge down that hall and get to that bathroom and get on my knees in front of the toilet bowl, do a few chin-ups on the rim, trying to find a comfortable place. You know, it seems to me there were mornings when I was going to throw up my very soul. Did you ever come out of a blackout and the room is spinning and I'm leaning down here, I'm leaning on my knees and my head's resting on the toilet and I'm trying to find something to stop the spin? And the two words that would always greet me, American Standard. Get up, get dressed, and make the run. Promise those kids, I would always promise the kids I wasn't going to go to the liquor store anymore. And here I am in the empty house now, and I'm still trying to keep, you know, the idea that they were still there. And I put on my tight jeans. I was 65 pounds overweight. I put on my bad leather jacket, shoved on my dark glasses, you know, put on starfire earrings that hung to my shoulders. I'm just going to make a run down to the nearest liquor store. And my mode of transportation by this time was a pair of gold fuzzy house slippers. Get to the front door, you know, and open it quietly, sneak down the steps in the darkness of the night, feeling like a thief. Just like a thief sneaking around in the dark to get to the liquor store. Stand outside and wait for the man to come. You know, something about clerks in the ghetto early in the morning, they can be very cruel. Sometimes I usually was the only customer, and he'd do play those games. You know, I always knew how to play the games of life. I just didn't know how to live it. Leaning on the counter. You know, by this time, you know, I'm not taking good care of myself. You know, when ripples coming out of the pores of your skin, it doesn't exactly smell like Chanel No. 5. And that had always been my fragrance. And I'm leaning on the counter and shaking. Sometimes I wet myself in front of that man. And the book talks about that feeling of pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. My wonderful, loving parents, and, you know, and with the fourth step, an eighth and ninth step, you know, they never dreamed that their baby daughter, you know, would end up standing in front of a liquor store clerk, wetting herself at 6 o'clock in the morning. Thank God that they didn't get to see that. Finally, this guy would lean on the counter. He was, he had beautiful white teeth, and he'd lean on there and put the ripple in the bag and then play with the bag at the top of the thing and say silly things to me like, "Honey, who's drinking all this ripple?" And I'd look at him and try to be cute. Man, I haven't been cute for a long time by now. And I'd say, "I have house guests." He said, "You serve your house guests ripple?" I take it out of his hand and, get past and lean on that building. You know, my days of fine drinking long been over. I didn't have to worry about, the proper bottle opener, and I used to drink out of Baccarat crystal glasses. And, listen to that mood music and the faces of smiling, handsome men. And there used to be a wonderful song during the jazz era. It says, smiling faces tell lies. You know, and I used to sit on those bar stools and in those fabulous clubs with fabulous people in that fast lane, and they'd all lie to me. And I can tell you, as I stand here, my heart filled with love for you. You know, not a million Alcoholics Anonymous has ever lied to me. When I walked into crawling my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, you said something to me that has rocketed my life into a fourth dimension. You said, "We love you, and do you want to stay sober?" And I said, "Yes." Surrendered. And you always told me the truth, and you told me what would set me free is the truth that set me free based on the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think those steps are spiritual in principle and honoring the traditions of this program. So on it went. And I ended up, I started ending up in places like hospitals, and not for the treatment of alcoholism, but for the treatment of being battered in the streets while I'm under the influence. What a terrible place to be. I came into this meeting. I grew up in the Baptist faith. My mother and father were wonderful people in the community, in their church, and they did everything possible to try to give me the message, and I never got it. I got it in Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I have learned that this is a spiritual program. And I found my God in this program. And ended up in those places, and I just couldn't stop it. Like the first speaker, I just couldn't stop. Once I took the drink took me, and then I gave it the power, and I couldn't stop drinking till that nightmare was over. One morning I was in a place, I don't know if any of you like sports, but basketball. If you look at the basketball games when they're on television, the Lakers play at a place called the Forum. One Sunday morning, one more time, the God that I'd come to believe in, which I seem to know now, would try to get my attention. I just couldn't see for looking. I was so busy looking, I couldn't see a thing. And I've been still trying to be a party girl up in Hollywood. I don't know how I got up there that night, but I came to that morning with my in the gutter on Crenshaw, with my head leaning against the curb and a foot with a black boot on it that had a cleat on the toe. That's all I remember. As I stand here 26 years later, kicking me in the head, and then I could hear my ribs cracking. And I know about pain, because pain has no memory. I'm living the life so beautifully described of insanity in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous as the jaywalker. I'm doing the same insane things over and over again with my insane friends and always expecting a different result. So there I was on that Sunday morning, and the next time I came out of that blackout and came to, paramedics picked me up. People who are dedicated to saving your life when you don't want your life saved. And, there were many times I sat in that overstuffed chair contemplating suicide, only to learn in Alcoholics Anonymous that suicide is a final solution to temporary problems. All my problems are resolved in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and being of service and giving back what was freely given to me through the grace of God. There I was, strapped down, nun standing by the side of the bed. She's become in my story and in my life, I call, you know, that spiritual being and an earth angel. The older nun was standing next. She had on a black habit. She had her hands through the sleeves. She had her horn rimmed glass. Wasn't thrilled with me at all. And police at the foot of the bed, because the older nun had called the police. And she was disturbed because I wouldn't talk to the police. Now, I grew up with a full-blooded Indian, Cherokee Indian father, who was born on a reservation in Cherokee, North Carolina, and had migrated to Atlanta, and he had continued to express his cultural learnings and teachings that he learned on that reservation. And he'd always told us, we don't tell secrets. We don't tell anybody else what we do. I hung out with the mafia for 10 years, and they said, you better not tell the secrets. And I wasn't telling these police anything. I told them to buzz off. And so she turned and she walked to the door and she stood in that door and she looked back at me. But something happened when she looked back at me. She just sadly shook her head and walked away. And I thought, whoa, as bad in the condition that I was in. But the young nun stood there, not over 24 years old, I guess about 23, with this white habit on, and all I could see was this part of her face. And her eyes were as blue as the heavens. This young nun started to cry. And as I watched the tears flow from her face on the covering of that bed, I looked out at her because I was bleeding out of the corner of my eyes. And she was wiping the blood away. And she quietly said to me, how did you ever let your life get into such a state? And no answer, but the question, people had always said to me, Clara, stop drinking. You can stop drinking. Go to church. Do this. Do that. Do that. Do this. And she never said, nobody had ever asked me before, but I didn't know. Surely not alcohol. You know, that's what I depend on for life. You know, it's my lover. It's my friend. It's my confidant. You know, what do I do? You know, I didn't give it another thought. 3 days later, that same young nun, apparently God is my guardian angel. I've come to believe in angels. And I've come to believe in miracles because they're real. And happen to those who are unafraid to believe in miracles. Because that was my miracle that morning. 3 days later, she was assigned to dress me. You should have seen her. Now, in those days, the way they treated alcoholics, they'd sweep us up off the streets and you know, paramedics, and they'd ambulance and rushes to the hospital, and if you they'd only hold you for like 72 hours, and whatever was wrong with you, you know, and now how they treated me, and that's what they were doing at the time. They used 2.5-inch white gauze, a tape, and they would just wrap. They'd walk around you with the tape and roll it off on to put the ribs back in place, and they put it on so tight so they'd have to, you know, grow knit together again. But it made you bend over. So here I am. She's dressing me. I'm bent over. I can't get the jacket, my bad leather jacket on. She's got it over my shoulders. You should have seen her trying to find out where the bangs went on the wig. Man, she was shifting it, you know. And then she said, no. And she shifted back that way, you know. And it was a matted mess, that wig, you know. And so finally she patted me on the head and she looked at me and she said, you look beautiful. The spiritual being that she is walked me to the front of Daniel Freeman Hospital. I stood on the sidewalk and I'm standing out there and I had on my bad boots that morning. Those were party boots. And she embraced me. And she kissed me, that young nun. And she said to me, try not to drink today. But you see, I'm an alcoholic. I shuffled off to the... If you don't think that's insanity, I shuffled off to the nearest liquor store. Bought my wine, went back to that little place where I lived. And I don't know what happened. About 3 weeks later, I'm healing again. I always healed on the outside, you know, and I stayed sick on the inside. I came to it on the floor on April the 9th, 1974. In a fetal position, I can still remember the stench of stale wine and a dirty body. Thank God there were no men in my life at that time, because by that time, men in my life had faces and no names. I paid that terrible price. I know that alcoholism is no gender. But I can speak for myself as a woman alcoholic and the miserable places that it put me in, you know, that I hope by God's grace in this prayer, I never have to go back to that again. And when I came out of that blackout on that dirty floor, I'd never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. All of my fair weather friends had died of this disease. I had one left who passed on when I was 10 years sober, and she died in that same ghetto. We had ended up two streets apart. And she stayed there, and I got to this program of miracles, and I stood up and I screamed, "God, if there is a God, please don't let me die." Death had been on the, you know, one of my fears since I was 5 or 6 years old. And doing my inventories, I've done many inventories through the years. I sponsor a lot of women. I'm a full believer in sponsorship. And once every year, we go through the inventory. We do the steps and the big book study. I'm starting one in a couple of weeks, I guess, for the end of this year. And in that inventory, it came out that when I was about 8 years sober, that fear of death was always about fire. And I remember growing up in that church, and it was one of the fears when I was 5 years old that I remember hearing in that church was, if you're not a good girl, you're going to die and you're going to burn in hell. And I remember, I finally, after 8 years, got to the basis of that fear. That's what the steps are about. We continue our recovery by keep on doing it until you find out some of the answers that always, in my case, haunted me. So I stood up and I said, "God, you know, don't let me die." And I called my last friend who was not an alcoholic, and she told me about Alcoholics Anonymous. I picked up the phone and I called central office that morning, and a man said, "Good morning, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. May I help you?" I said to him in my best street language, see, because I know all about the streets, you know, and I said to him, "My name is Claire and I can't stop drinking," and the truth was finally out. He said, "Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous, dear." He said, "Don't drink today." Now, for an alcoholic intellectual like me, that just didn't seem possible. How could you live a whole day without drinking? And I said, "Well, do you think I can do it?" He said, "Oh, just try." And I say to you newcomers, just try. Just try to do it one day at a time. And so I said, "Well, all right, I'll see what I can do." And I just told you my story with all my arrogance. I say to him, "Well, now, do you have meetings in Beverly Hills?" And he said, "Yes, we do. But you're going to the meeting in your neighborhood." I said, "Okay." Called my brother, who was working at LAX at the time, and for Delta Airlines, and I told him, I called him, I said, "I think I found a place for me, and it's called Alcoholics Anonymous." And the man on the phone told me they're going to help me stop drinking. And he said, "Oh, baby," he said, "I'm so glad." He said, "You know, the family, we love you so much, but we just don't know what else to do." He said, so I said, "But I need a car," because I'd lost my big white Eldorado. It'd been gone. And I said, "I need a car to go to the meeting. They have meetings." And he said, "I'll leave the car on my way home from work." And he left it. And so that morning, he worked the night shift, so that morning he left the car. So I started to get dressed that morning for my first time, for my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know what you guys were about. I was still standing when I was walking around, and I had not had a desire to go to the liquor store. And I don't know what that was about. It didn't occur to me to go to the liquor store. I went and looked in the closet on what to wear so I'd look good. I'm standing there for half an hour. I got one dress. It's a red velvet dress with wine stains on it. And I'm a half hour trying to make a decision on what to wear. And I cleaned it up and got the wine stains off, got that wig out, put it on the head farm. You ladies know what I'm talking about. And cut the better bangs, sprayed it up. She looked wonderful. She looked great. And I didn't know about the language. I didn't know about detox. I never heard of it. I never knew anything about this. And I just realized my body started, my muscles started like pulling, and it was painful, and I was a little dizzy, and I couldn't get it together, and I was shuffling around in that house, and by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, my arms are folded, and I'm rocking up back and forth in the living room, trying to keep from going to the liquor store. So I, finally I couldn't stand it, so I decided to go over Woolworths and just browse. So I'm browsing, and so I stole some eyelashes for my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, they come quite long, and I didn't know he was supposed to trim them down to size. I was at 8 o'clock meeting, 7 o'clock, I'm standing in front of the mirror, and I'm looking. I got my red dress on. The wig is in place. Perspiration's pouring down. But I'm shaking so badly. Those lashes come with a little tube of glue. So I got these and I'm squeezing it along the edge of the lash. Grab my elbow. I wait for an opportune moment. I slam it in. One end's down here. The other end's up here. I'm too tired to start all over. I lean in the mirror and I say, "You are looking good." And I went off to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I shall never forget that night. I walk up there and Scotty, who's my friend, still my friend, he's 38 years sober, was a breeder. He said, "Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous." And he said, "Get yourself a cup of coffee." And in those days, they had real coffee cups in all the meetings. And I went over to the table where the coffee pot was sitting on the table. And I poured some coffee, and it was too full. And I was shaking so bad, I didn't want you to see that. So I left it on the table. And I went back, and I sat on the first row at the end of the row by the aisle on my hands, because in those days, they didn't have any program. They didn't know about the chemical part of withdrawals. And I'm sitting on my hands and I'm shaking and I'm perspiring. And they talk about, you know, the drowning person whose life flashed before them. And my whole life flashed before me. And what I saw was that alcohol had stripped me of all human dignity. Had stripped me of all moral values, all family values, all those wonderful Christian values that my parents had tried so hard to get me to see. And as I shook and they started the meeting, they asked for the hands of the newcomer, and I didn't know what that was. And the lady behind me touched me on my shoulders, and she said, "You're a newcomer, honey." She said, "Raise your hands." So I raised my hands as a newcomer. And at that meeting, the first speaker was the late Gail Wilson. And she walked to that podium and she talked about things I'd never heard another human talk about. She talked about the feelings of being lonely, the feelings of being afraid, of not being able, you know, those feelings of low self-worth and low self-esteem, and not feeling any sense of being. And I felt nobody had ever said that before. And at the coffee break, Carol gave me her phone number, and she said, "My name is Carol, and I'm going to sponsor you." And she put her arms around me, and I smelled so bad. I was so ashamed. And I looked in her eyes, you know, and it's like I look into your eyes, and when I look into your eyes, It's like looking into the window of your souls. And I saw her love for me. She never said to me, when I was out there in that world, in that highfalutin world, when in those cocktail parties, and the first thing they said to you is, where did you go to school? Where do you live? You know, what do you do? She said to me, call me, and I'll tell you what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. And Carol is my sponsor as I stand here this morning. 26 years later, my friend, my confidant, and my spiritual teacher. We got into the steps. I got sober in 74 with 20 other sober newcomers. And out of the 20, five have passed away of natural causes, and the other 15 are still sober. Not one of us has ever gone out. We learned right from the beginning. Some of you may have heard Sean A., who lives in Canada, now got sober with Sean. I got sober April the 9th. He got sober 2 weeks later. I have never let him forget that. And service, and that was to talk to us right from the very beginning. How important it was to participate in our own sobriety by getting into the steps and until we can learn to live the steps. I live the steps of the day to the best of my ability. The teaching begins at the beginning. And it started, I do a lot of prison work. As I said earlier, I sponsor a lot of women. And this is the process. When I was 6 months sober, I had to still live in the ghetto because I was not physically able to work. When I walked into that first meeting, I had open wine sores on my body. And I had fluid on my joints and my ankles where I couldn't walk very well, so I was not employable. But finally, I really had never liked to work very much. I didn't know much about working, except when I had the business with that husband. And I said to my sponsor, said, Clara, you got to get a job. You're getting better, honey. And I said, well, I don't know how to do anything. She said, well, I don't care what you do, just do it. We're self-supporting through our own contributions. Yeah, and the mafia is no longer taking care of you, sweetheart. You get a job. And my first job was as a waitress, and I was a terrible waitress. I spilled a lot of coffee on people. And I'd go to my home group. I hope you all have a home group. My home group is the Robinson Originals in L.A. And I would stay in that meeting, and I would get into, just whine. I whined my first 2 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember being in a meeting there one night, and this lovely man, he's passed on now, was in the back of the room, and I'm whining about how awful people out there in that world are to me. And he came up to me, put his arms around me. He said, Clara, please, come down off the cross. He said, honey, we need the wood. when I was, I got on with that, I made amends to those kids. They were at the top of my list. I remember that older son by this time had gone into a profession in television and theater and movies. And, he had never come down to see me, and he just walked out of my life for 3 years. And he came back, and I made my amends to him, and I told him how sorry I was never there for him. But when I was when making that amends, it's very difficult because it's painful. I never wanted to admit ever in my life that I was wrong. And so, but my sponsor said, I don't care what, my sponsor used to say to me, the only way to grow is to do the thing you fear and dread to do the most. That's the only way you're going to grow. You just got to do it. And when I did it, it was such a relief that I was able to say to him, I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't live like that anymore. And I said, you can see, he could see the changes in my life. And he looked at me. He was a wonderful young man and very spiritual. And he said, Mom, he said, that was yesterday. We're not promised tomorrow. He said, as a family, and I'm a double winner. I'm also a member of Al-Anon. And he said, in the family after, he said, in the big book, in the family after, he said, let's move on from this point and let's all heal together. And that's the way it's been. And that two younger ones, I started to see, and the promises coming true. When I was 5 years old, saw my daughter go to the Ice Capades. The first professional black skater with Dorothy Hamill's tour. The grandparents had paid for that expensive training. When I was 7 years sober, my son Ken, was drinking and using drugs and came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was very active for quite a while, and he stopped going to meetings. And his life is not in the best place today. 3 or 4 months ago, he attempted suicide, you know, and we move on. We don't drink no matter what, because that's life. I found out one wonderful thing in this program, that life is life. And what we learn here is how to show up and be accept life on its terms in God's grace. And I went back into that business that I, when I was about 3 years sober. And I want to tell you something. My primary purpose is to stay sober, and because life will happen, and whatever's going to happen will happen. But I became, you know, whatever that is. And I'm in property management and maintenance, and what I do is in Los Angeles is I have my company. I have contracts to the homes of the movie stars and the rich and the famous. And I do the best job I can, and I'm proud of my work today. And I don't steal, and I don't lie, and I don't cheat, and I just depend on God's grace. And I have a wonder. I love doing what I do, and it's a wonderful experience. When I was 3 or 4 years sober, I want to tell you something. There's something about getting well in Alcoholics Anonymous when all those things start coming back. And I was starting to get well, you know, when I was 3 or 4 years sober. And it was one of the experiences I hope I never get well again, because I almost went out there and got into that world again, because, you know, the insanity returns just like Dr. Silkworth says it will. You know, Dr. Silkworth says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol, which always brought me that feeling of fantasy. And when you get back out there, and I stopped going to meetings, so I'm just passing that along to the newcomers. You know, when you get here, you don't get well. You just keep doing what you're doing one day at a time. When I was, I guess, about 6, 7 years ago, that older son of mine was working and living in New York. He was working at ABC Television, and he was an assistant to the anchors, some of them are still there on that 6 o'clock news. And he was very successful, and he was so wonderful. What a wonderful young man he was. And it was at that time, I don't know if any of you have heard of Studio 54. And he got involved. He was one of the first participants. He loved, you know, that's when cocaine was still just out there on the streets. And him with the gold chain and the spoon, and we'd share a lot. You know, I used to go to New York, and we'd just have a great time. And mine was alcohol, and his was cocaine. I really didn't know, you know, the effect of it at the time, because I was never into my alcohol. My drug was alcohol. And so then something happened, and when his contract was over, he moved back to Los Angeles, met a young lady. They got married and had a little son, moved up to Northern California. And he was teaching at the college level, theater arts, and the marriage didn't last, and they got a divorce. And he stayed there, and they went other places. I have a wonderful grandson, and his name is Aaron. And, you know, when he was quite young, he's 13 now, but when he was really quite young and around L.A., you know, whenever he said, Grandma, he said, you know, can we go to the park? And I'd drop everything, cancel all my big appointments, because, you see, I never could do that for his dad. I always made the promises, never could show up. And I was later to hear that son tell me that, you know, you were never there for me. And mostly when he was little, you know, when we, instead of going to the park, we always went to Toys R Us. And I have a little granddaughter. But that son called me one day, and he said, Mom, he said, you know, because he was shooting cocaine and sharing the needles. He said, Mom, he said, I don't know what's happening, but I had some tests today, and I'm HIV positive. I cannot tell you that kind of pain. I remember holding that phone away from my ears and doing what you taught me to do. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things that can, the wisdom to know the difference. And he said, but I feel okay now. The doctor said, in those days, they had no medication for it. He said, I feel all right now, he said, and I'll just keep calling you, you know, when the time comes that I get too sick, he said, I'll call you. But then the next day I was on a plane walking around San Francisco with that son that I couldn't take to the park. And we kept up that real relationship all the time, and I'd fly time to time. And then came that other call. Mom, 19 months later, Mom, I'm too sick to take care of myself, and I'm going to die. And I'm glad I have a place to come to, because I want to die at home with you. And he flew home, and I had a place for him. My sponsees and my sponsor and the Earth Angels, I call all of you guys, the members of Alcoholics Anonymous, were there for me for all those months when he got so ill. I went from 175 pounds to 99 pounds. And I cannot tell you that kind of pain. The being beaten in the street, none of that, you know, that pain goes away, but this is another kind of pain. And then came that awful morning, 10:15, and my sponsees, and he had done some work with the Grateful Dead. He'd written some music and stuff for them, and one of them heard that he was dying of AIDS, and they wrote something for him, some lyrics, and he had a musician friend put some lyrics to it, and my sponsees and all stood around that bed with my sponsor, and we sang, because that was, he could no longer, at the end they can't talk, so he wrote a note and asked us would we sing and help him cross that bridge. So we were singing, it was that rasping sound of death, and then it was quiet, and he was gone. And I stood there with my heart about to explode from another kind of pain. There was a legal pad on that nightstand. And out of my despair, I picked up that pen and I wrote God a letter, not a note. And I said, "Dear God, thank you for using me as a channel to have brought your child into this universe. And thank you for taking him out of his pain and bringing him into your loving arms." And I said a few more things, but all I said was, "Forgive me for any pain that I caused him in his young life." And it was over. You know, there's been a lot of life, a loss. I lost 5 members of my family in 5 years. And our wonderful members of Alcoholics Anonymous, at this time, last couple of weeks ago, I was at a memorial service. And I look back over the great, a lot of you old-timers may remember, Alabama Carruthers. She would have been 40 years sober, and she passed away a few years ago, who was my mentor also in this program. And when I look at all of them, I pray that all of their souls rode the wings of angels to a higher place. No more crying, no more dying, and no more pain. It's by the grace of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's given me the life that I never would have imagined in my wildest fantasy. And I thank you for my life. And I pray that you newcomers will come back and get on this road. Sometimes the road gets narrow, but the vision gets wider in the process to a loving God in the process, in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you. God bless you. And thank you for having me. Bye.